The perfect combination of versatile athleisure and training apparel has arrived. Thanks to the visionary minds of New Balance, Clutch Athletics, and Rich Paul, the designs reflect the heart of the athlete and the spirit of the community. With rising defensive football stars Will Anderson and Chase Young on the roster, Clutch Athletics brings the best innovative gear to all athletes, giving them style and performance on and off the field. Learn more and purchase Clutch Athletics at NewBalance.com.
Welcome to the Cover 3 Podcast with your hosts, Chip Patterson and Barton Simmons. It's your call for the best college football coverage. From National Signing Day to the National Championship and everything in between, CBS Sports presents the Cover 3 Podcast.
And welcome back to the Cover 3 Podcast here on CBS Sports. That's Barton Simmons. That's Tom Fornelli. I'm Chip Patterson. We got a lot to get to. It's Monday, so you know we'll be dipping into that mailbag. We've also got our third edition of the book club, and we've got some breaking news, breaking of sorts, official news over the weekend as Carl Durrell is named the head coach at Colorado. We've got a lot to get to here in the coming weeks because guess what? Now, finally, after I think 150-something days, the coaching carousel has finished. We started in September with Chris Ash getting fired by Rutgers, and now the carousel has finally stopped spinning on like February 22nd, February 23rd. So, you know, all of our grading the coaching hires, who won the offseason, all that stuff that we know you want a piece of, we're going to have that for you in the coming weeks. Also, it's Combine Week, so later this week we might sort of give you our college angle on the Combine. Don't forget that this was where you got the award-winning Golden Dumbbell Awards for after the Combine is over. So my colleagues now, Barton Simmons, Tom Fornelli, you guys brought the heat on the Golden Dumbbell Awards last season. As we are in Combine Week, are you as excited to see the next group of NFL prospects in their skimpies getting it done and showing off that speed, physicality, and flexibility?
Well, as we tee this podcast up, we're already in the midst of heavy hand season right now. Joe Burrow measured in at 9 inches. He would potentially have the smallest hands of a first round quarterback since 2008. I think is what I saw. It's important stuff here. We're digging in.
My annoyance with the Combine this year is I have long been a joyful viewer of the Combine.
Yeah. But
it was always during the day, and now they've moved it to primetime. And that kind of messes me up because, like, the Combine, part of its appeal was the fact that it was on all day.
Yeah, so I agree with that.
Yeah, at home, working like we do or wherever, we're able to watch it while working and do that kind of stuff, whereas now, you know, there's other sports going on at night. So I'm going to be interested to see how this does ratings wise, if they're going to realize this was a mistake for them. But I'm still excited. I'll be watching. I love this stuff. I'm an idiot. Plus, I got to get, info for my mock drafts.
It's the perfect thing to be on while you're just doing your work. And you just look up and you see a fast 40, if you want to rewind something, miss it, you can. But it's the perfect sort of complimentary viewing for just working with something on the side. But if I got to convince my wife that at like dinner time, I got to sit down and watch these dudes in short shorts and tidy whities running a 40-yard dash or doing a three cone drill, that's a little tougher sell.
All right, let's get into the closing of the coaching carousel. It is Colorado announcing the hire of Carl Durrell as the new head coach. He fills in after Mel Tucker left to go take the Michigan State job. Carl Durrell is not one of the coaches that we have discussed in our time of looking at where Colorado may go next and discussing the updates on the Colorado coaching search. We discussed Brett Bielema pretty extensively on the podcast. We discussed Troy Calhoun, the Barton Simmons endorsed coach, right choice coach, but we land at Carl Durrell. And so I guess the Since we weren't mentioning him, and he was the head coach at UCLA before, that is his most recent time as a head coach in college football. He was the associate head coach for Brian Flores for the Miami Dolphins in the NFL at the time of his hire. All right, Tom, I'll throw it to you first. Like, did you have him on a list of expectations? And at the time that it was announced, how far did you get in your research before you felt like you had a good grade or feel for the hire?
He was nowhere near my list of possible candidates that I thought Colorado would go to. Because like you said, the names we talked about and the names we'd been floating out, you felt like those were solid options and that, okay, well, whoever it ends up being, it's probably going to be one of those, because when you look at the timing of the hire and that kind of stuff, you have a limited field of what you can go for. And Darrell, I mean, it's weird because you mentioned he was the head coach at UCLA for five seasons, from 2003 to 2007. And he was, you know, pretty okay in those five seasons. He had a 10-win.
Pretty okay. Yeah. I mean, that's a hell of a description there.
He had four very mediocre seasons where they were either like 6-7, 6-6, or 7-6.
That's the okay part of it.
Yeah. And then the very was the 2005 season when he went 10-2.
There you go. There's the pretty part of it.
So it's like, clearly it's one of those things where, like, I feel like Carl Durrell's 5 years at UCLA, unless you are like a UCLA fan or like somebody who works in college football or like a hardcore college football fan, it's probably one of the more forgettable, like, oh yeah, that's right, Carl Durrell was the coach at UCLA for 5 years, I totally forgot about that guy. So it's weird because, yeah, that's the only time he's ever been a head coach as far as I know. And the last time he was even in college was for one season. He was the offensive coordinator, quarterback coach at Vandy in 2014. But since leaving UCLA after 2007, that 1 year as Vandy's OC was the only season he spent on the college level. He'd been in the NFL for the most part since then. So to that hiring come out of nowhere, it's nothing about Carl Durrell. He could be perfectly good for Colorado. I mean, he did spend time. He spent two seasons at Colorado as its wide receiver coach. He spent four seasons at Colorado as the OC/wide receiver coach. He's got plenty of connections. He's from Alameda, California. He's from Southern California. He played at UCLA. So he has those kind of connections that you want as far as, you know, coaching connections, recruiting connections, and familiarity with the school. So these are all, you know, check marks in the pro side for his, you know, his candidacy for the job. It's just, it's very unexpected. And I feel like either one of two things happened. Either A, he got an interview and absolutely killed it in the interview. Like, he had a plan, and Rick George is sitting there like, "Ooh, wow, this is the guy I need to go with." Or B, and I think this is the more likely option, not to say that Carl didn't do well in the interview and isn't, you know, again, this has nothing to do with Carl. But when you look at Mel Tucker, he was getting what, about $2.5 million?
He was getting 2.7, I think.
Yeah, so he was getting around that kind of range, and then Michigan State comes and throws a bunch of money. And you look at the candidates for the gig, you had Burt, you know, you had Sark, who were the two big-name previous head coaching guys who were, by all reports, very much in the running for the job until suddenly they were no longer in the running. I'm wondering if the interview process with those guys went through the, okay, what's your plan? What would you do? Blah, blah, blah. And then it got to money talk, and maybe their demands were a little unrealistic or more than Colorado was comfortable going with, as far as, you know, like what we saw, what Michigan State gave Mel Tucker and which Colorado didn't match. Because I'm guessing Burt's not trying to come back to make $2.5 million a year. I don't think Sark's coming to make $2.5 million a year. I think they're going to want like around that $4 million range, which is kind of like a going rate these days, plus all the money for your assistants and all that kind of stuff. And I'm just wondering if Carl Durrell wasn't the more affordable option for Colorado moving forward with all the coaching changes it's had and turnover it's had in recent years with guys coming to poach. So maybe that's what this was. Maybe it was a combination of Durrell doing well in their interview and also being affordable, because maybe Durrell wanted to get back into the head coaching instead of being an assistant, and he feels like this is his best path to doing that, and that, you know, he's willing to take maybe a little less money than other guys for the opportunity.
Yeah, I mean, I am typically skew optimistic on coaching hires because we don't really know, because we're not in the interview process. We don't know what the pitch was, and guys that we think are bad hires or good hires all the time, and vice versa. So I'm an optimist on these things, but this is a tough one for me to get behind. It's a tough one for me to understand. On the plus side, let's just acknowledge some of the other hires we've been a little skeptical of in the past. I mean, from kind of the retread coach brand, right? So Mac Brown's looking like a good hire at North Carolina. Herm Edwards is looking like a quality hire at Arizona State. Even go back to, I'm not comparing Carl Durrell to Pete Carroll, but I mean, Pete Carroll wasn't a guy anyone was excited about as a sort of a bounce back NFL guy. And obviously he was great. And so there's examples of this working in the past. That said, so here's my exposure to Carl Durrell. So I kind of called around, talked to a couple of friends that have had exposure to him on a more insightful level than I have. So I got a buddy that played for him at UCLA. I live in Nashville. You know, I've got kind of an up close look at the Vanderbilt program. He was the offensive coordinator at Vanderbilt. I know people who have coached with him at Vanderbilt and at Miami. So I just sort of poked around. UCLA buddy, I was like, your boy's getting hired at Colorado. How about that? And he was like, that's not my boy.
Ooh.
And said, I wasn't a big fan and team didn't really like him that much. Now, to be fair, this was a guy that was recruited by Bob Toledo and just played at the very tail end of his career under Carl Durrell. So I don't really even, like, that's a long time ago. I don't really hold that against him. But I think all the things that Tom said are fair to just bring up that, look, it was a fairly mediocre tenure at UCLA. The people I've talked to that have coached with him, you get some positives. Like, his reputation is very smart. He is he's a good person. He's a very good coach in a position group. I think he's a really good communicator in that level, sort of in that sort of one-on-one setting as a teacher. I think he's got a really good reputation. As a head coach or as running a room, even as a coordinator, the knock is he doesn't have a lot of juice. Like, it doesn't have he's a little bit more in that, I think, NFL like mindset of, you know, the job is to teach and it's less to sort of discipline and motivate. So I think that's going to be a question that is he has to answer at Colorado. And then, look, I think just from watching his offenses at Vanderbilt the year he was there, he was only there 1 year and he was let go. It was horrible. Like, in a history of horrible football at Vanderbilt, that was one of the worst Vanderbilt seasons I've ever seen. Now, I don't think Carl Durrell deserves all the blame for that. I think Derek Mason meddled a little bit and was figuring out the head coach stuff at that point, and so hard to know what to pin on him, but it wasn't a pretty sight. And so I think where I finally land on it is just, all right, you got a guy that was mediocre at a better program when the Pac-12 was probably in a better position to be successful, generally speaking. You've got a coach that is, I would assume, capable as a recruiter. But that's not his thing. Like, he didn't come in with some recruiting energy and recruiting game plan that Colorado couldn't have had with Darren Shiverini. And then just what is he going to provide offensively that he's, you know, didn't provide in his last stint on the college level? I'm underwhelmed with this hire. And you know, so we'll see what happens.
There's a question that I wanted to lead off the mailbag with that's a little bit tied to this, but I want to go ahead and get the discussion started a little early, which is aspect of it, which is that I wonder if we, being the media and experts who talk about it, either aren't getting it right with what the recipe is for a college head football coach, whether college football is just changing such that our expectations for who can or who would be good at running a college football program, whether that's all changing, or whether the athletic directors have gotten together with search firms to sort of develop this other list that includes candidates that aren't necessarily on all the candidates that we're getting from experts who write for national outlets, even our own, Tom Fornelli included, because there is a longer list of coaches who get dubbed as, quote, rising stars in the industry. There's a long list of coaches who are brought up, whose names are brought up often for pretty much any Power Five job that comes available. You know, whether they are from the one familiar bucket, which is one of the top group of five coaches, whether they're from the other familiar bucket, which is one of the top coordinators at the Power Five level. And yet we have, and you mentioned, you know, Mac Brown and Herm Edwards, but the sense that I've gotten from the last maybe just 2 to 3 coaching carousels is that either there's a bunch of athletic directors and university presidents that are trying to do some smartest man or woman in the room type stuff. Like, they think that by ducking the usual expectations or by taking a different route for their head coaching hire, that they might be able to make the splash or have the kind of results that don't follow whatever sequence they've been through. But I find it interesting that what we expect as the credentials for a college football head coach at a Power Five job in 2020, it does not equal what my expectations of it would be. And in terms of what your prior experience needs to be, in terms of having proven success on the recruiting trail or any of these other aspects that you would normally have with, again, a group of five head coach who has been moving his way up, or B, one of the top coordinators who's been moving his way up through the college game. It sure seems like those classically identified credentials of a good hire just don't matter anymore. And I wonder, and for the purposes of discussion, do you think they still matter? And why do you think that we are seeing some more, like, some of the names that would be on traditional paths to head coaching jobs are not getting those head coaching jobs because schools are not making traditional hires?
So is that a way of saying that you think that this hire may not be so bad?
Yeah. Oh, I have no idea whether it will be good or bad, because I have no good college football centric notes on Carl Durrell. I'm going in with a blank slate. I mean, yeah, he was at UCLA, but I mean, how different is the college navigating the college football world now than it was in 2007? I just to go ahead
to go along with the point you're making, though, using that same point where I'm going in with a blank slate as well. I'm not enthusiastic about this hire. I think you'd have a hard time finding a Colorado fan who is like, "Oh boy, we're excited. This is the guy we wanted." But are the odds of Carl Durrell doing what you want or what you're looking for as far as the level of success? And I'm not talking about national titles or any of that kind of stuff, just the level of success that you are looking for with your football program. Are the odds that Carl Durrell is going to attain that level so much better than somebody like Cheverini, who is another untested, unproven commodity, that he's worth hiring? Because I feel like if you're at the situation where Durrell is your answer, I think that you could make an argument that Cheverini, with his recruiting acumen and his, you know, his youth and just maybe the energy around him. And again, Carl Durrell might be like a great rah-rah guy. I don't know. I'm not familiar enough with Durrell to really have a solid opinion.
Yeah, he's not a rah-rah guy.
Yeah. So is there not an argument to make that Cheverini might have a higher ceiling and probably could have been a very similar hire, and also might have been, with the familiarity, might have been a more exciting hire for the fan base?
Yeah,
I think he probably would have been.
Yeah, I definitely think that there's a great argument there. And I like, Tom, that you brought this up, because it when Barton said something. So sometimes the like most deeply impactful or prescient realizations are sort of tied in the unique packages, and you know, things are done in mysterious ways. But when Barton said that Mel Tucker whispered that good sex into Michigan State's ear, I think he was really tapping into a part of my questions about this. You know, like, I think that now more than ever, candidates are being given chances to sit down with the athletic director, and it doesn't matter like who's carrying water for you in the columns and in the write-ups, and it doesn't really matter who's pushing for you from an alumni standpoint, that if you sit down and if you're able to present a plan and if you're able to convince an athletic director and university president within your presentation that you've got the idea, like, it's not the Dabo Swinney Ed Ogeron effect, but it sort, or maybe it's maybe the more Herm Edwards effect, which is Herm Edwards came in, I mean, and yes, he did have a very close friendship with the athletic director. He might have been starting on first base with that one. But I really do think that you're given the opportunity now, because a lot of the – there have been a lot of coaches who've been successful who have not done the traditional stops to success. And I think that's leading athletic directors to be a little bit more open-minded into who they think about for a traditional – head coaching job. If Brett Bielema, and I do not mean to single him out because I believe that he would be the type of person to do this, but if he showed up with a notebook that just had Wisconsin scratched out, Arkansas scratched out, and then he wrote Colorado on it right below that, like if he's coming in with the same copy and pasted game plan and he's forgotten to change, like he forgot to change the name on the term paper, he's just showing up with old documents, then maybe that wasn't as impressive as Carl Durrell coming in with everything perfectly laminated, everything perfectly identified. He scouted the roster already. I just wonder if there's some of that almost, I guess, a business type mindset that's being applied to the college football hires.
Yeah. Well, that's
go ahead,
Tom. Go ahead.
I was just gonna make a stupid joke.
Timing related?
Yeah, you mentioned Burt's binder, and it's like it just dawned on me, you know, Wisconsin, Arkansas, Colorado, Badgers, Razorbacks, Buffaloes. It's like Burt's got a thing for like somewhat ornery mammals.
He is an ornery mammal.
Sort of on brand, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's the whole point, is like we aren't in those interviews, and I know that's a cop out in as it relates to grading these hires, but I'm giving it the grade based on what I know, and that's a low grade. But yeah, maybe Carl Durrell had a plan that blew everyone else's out of the water. Maybe he did. But if we're gonna go hire former UCLA coaches or former Pac-12 guys, this is the first. I have not floated this. I don't know whether there's a history at Colorado here or whether this would be totally rejected by the fan base or not, but like if we're just talking about retread coaches that have been in the Pac-12 before, I would be more inclined to go with a Rick Neuheisel than I would a Carl Durrell, a guy who has big personality, big energy, has sort of sat on the sidelines and kind of watched this thing and has sort of figured out the best way to attack it by talking to people every day. Like that would be a more inspiring hire. And so I just want to know, and we're sitting here during this podcast, this is like the Colorado Carl Durrell presser is going on. So maybe they're unloading just binders of information of why this is going to work. But
he did call it his dream job. So this is going to work.
There you go. Dream job. Only one of those.
Unless you're Todd Graham.
That's right.
If you're Todd Graham, you have many, many dream jobs.
In my introductory press conference studying, I did not find Todd Graham mention Hawaii as his dream job. So sucks for Hawaii.
Rainbow Warriors are screwed. Yeah. If I was hired as a coach in the press conference, I'd be like, it's always been my dream to have a job, and this is a job.
It's a dream job.
It's my dream job.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so our final ruling for now is not high grade from Barton. Empty slate, no expectations. Chip and Tom, maybe he whispered the sweet sex.
No, if I'm forced to grade it, I mean, based on what we know, I can't give it anything higher than a C. I'd probably go D plus because he's got experience and he's got familiarity with the Pac-12, Colorado, and like recruiting in California. It's just, I don't know. Again, it's, I feel like if, like I said, if you were going to go this route, I probably would have just gone with Cheverini.
If you're going to, I mean, it was reported that it was Troy Calhoun's job if he wanted it.
Yeah.
This is from the Colorado Gazette. Can you confirm you have interviewed at Colorado? Calhoun, I was at practice today, and we're going to get the Air Force Falcons a little bit better. That was our aim today. That's our sole goal. Colorado Gazette. Was there truth to what you saw in the media? Calhoun, I haven't looked at the media. I haven't watched the media. Not regrettably. Maybe regrettably. I haven't seen a thing. We've done nothing but meet. We've done nothing but practice. That's what I'm going to do, and that's what we wanted to get done today. Gazette, did you not talk to your staff yesterday and tell them what had happened? Calhoun, that what? Gazette, that you had interviewed. Calhoun, did I? Gazette, that's what I've heard. Calhoun, well, write that then. If that's what we did, if we told our staff that, then write that. And if you think that's accurate and that's what you heard, write that. I wouldn't say just a source is that really is the truth. We told our staff there's freedom to write whatever we want to write about this. I'm all about football. That's what we're doing. We're about Air Force football, and that's what we did today. Is there an adverse effect on football? Today! Here's what we did today. What do you got in terms of what we did today?
I mean, Troy Calhoun must have just been punching walls in his house and like, why the hell is Rick George hanging me out to dry like this? This dude had spring practice where he's being reported as the lead candidate, and he's got to go out there in spring practice and answer questions. And by the way, who knew Air Force's media coverage was going to come that hard?
I'm very disappointed that that Troy Calhoun was not the hire if he wanted to be the hire, and it certainly, I don't know, it's just crazy because Eric Bieniemy, he wants to stay. We discussed that. You've hit this next level of the search where Troy Calhoun's job, if he wants it, is the report. You know, Brett Bielema obviously has expressed interest in the job. Cheverini's right there, and then out of this other door, here comes Carl Durrell. So, I mean,
I'm guessing that was the last shot Troy Calhoun is ever going to have at a Power 5 job. If Colorado's not going to hire him, I don't know who's going to hire him. He ain't getting any younger.
It's disappointing. And Rick Neuheisel, by the way, you know, you talk about him being – he was the head coach at Colorado from 1995 to 1998. Which in the college football world was like yesteryear.
Yeah.
But the man's only 59 years old.
Yeah.
They were wearing them big ass shoulder pads back then.
Rick's got it if he wants it. I'm going to start floating that out there. No sources told me Rick Neuheisel's interested in the job. At Chip Patterson. Coming up on the other side, your questions, our answers, and the third installment of the Cover 3 Book Club. Next.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend? Or do something a little more epic and conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
All right, let's take a dive on into the mailbag. Our first question, mentioned it a little bit as it somewhat relates to Colorado, that this is focused a lot more on our blue bloods. So here we go. From TCasper31. Great pod, guys. What role do you believe athletic directors have in the success of football program at some of the top football schools in the country? Parentheses, his suggestion. Ohio State, Oklahoma, Alabama, etc. Having an argument with some friends that the university's resources and football coach have a far greater impact than who is chosen to be the AD. For example, it didn't take a sharp AD to hire Saban and Meyer at Alabama and Ohio State, since those were obviously the guys for the jobs. And they seemed more attracted to the tradition and resources at the school than who their boss was. So the question is, do we believe that who the athletic director is has a role in the success of the football program, especially at some of these top football schools?
I mean, I think the athletic administration plays a major role in the success of the football program. And the athletic director is obviously leads that charge. I think the athletic director, yes. I mean, the single most important job of an athletic director is to hire a head football coach. But just picking Nick Saban, I mean, you got to have Nick Saban's got to trust you that this is the right job. You obviously have to get him signed. And then I think there's also, I mean, when you look at like I remember talking to going and visiting when Will Healy was at Austin Peay, and that program had lost 45 out of the last 46 games or something, and this first year they were winless, and but he had total support from his athletic director to give him all kinds of resources that a 45 losses in 46 games team wouldn't dream of having, just in terms of making the guys feel like they are they're not playing at a disadvantage, that they're teach them what it feels like to be in a big time program, and then they'll fake it till you make it kind of deal. And that kind of worked. Look at what's going on at Vanderbilt right now, right down the road. It just seems like it's impossible for that program to ever get the kind of support from the school to where it's not just going to be a doormat SEC program. I agree with the point, and generally speaking, that head coach is really kind of all that matters. But I think that there's more to it than that. Gene Smith, I'm not sure. Is Urban Meyer at Ohio State, if any athletic director is there? I'm not sure that's the case. Because Urban Meyer, of all people, understands what it takes to be successful, so he needs an athletic director that's willing to work with him on that front.
Yeah, I think you could make an argument that at a blue blood program, maybe it's not as important because so much is already kind of in place. But I still think you can't just dismiss the athletic department or the AD as a whole, because like Barton just went over there, it's important to know it's not just hiring the football coach. It's having the support. It's also knowing what to look for in a coach, because I think that if you look for smaller schools, not the blue bloods, I think it's extremely important, because while there's no surefire coach that you could hire, there's never a sure thing. Even with Saban and Meyer, they both worked because they're both very good coaches, and they had good ADs, they had good programs, they had good support. They put it all together and bang, you get what you get out of it. So in that sense, having the right AD is very important. But there also are some athletic directors who are not just devoted to, what it needs to do to have a successful football program, but at smaller schools have shown a history of being able to recognize who a good hire would be for their program. You see ADs that more that often than not get it right than they do it wrong. And you see a lot of ADs who, no matter where they've gone, no matter what advantages they might have had at their current school or their old school, can never seem to hire the right person for the job. So, yeah, I do think that the athletic director is very important, and that if you have a good, smart athletic director who is able to not only identify coaching talent, but knows what it takes to give that coach what they need to develop their program and get it to where they want to go, that's a huge advantage for any school.
Case-by-case basis. And one thing that I would add to the responsibility of the athletic director, where your role in success of the football program is absolutely influential, it's going to be your relationship with two different sort of bodies. The first is going to be your booster club or your big donors, like whatever the group is called at your particular school. The athletic director can be... The athletic director needs to have a good relationship with that group, because that is a way to be a middle man or woman between the football coach and that group, and to be able to understand what that group of donors and boosters wants, what they're willing to give money for, what the football program needs. Connect those two, and you can have a lot at your fingertips very quickly. You know, you need to be able to make the right investments and understand where the money needs to go. I think that the relationship between football program and big donors and boosters, the athletic director is absolutely a huge part of that. Usually there's like one president of that group that they need to have a specific relationship with. And then the second one is the athletic director with the university president, because if you don't have the support of the university administration and the people that oversee, you know, how resources are allocated around the school, then you're not going to get the kind of support necessarily that you need in order to be successful and meet the expectations of pretty much any Power Five college football program. Whether those expectations at a place like Alabama and Ohio State are to compete for national championships, or if you have a little bit of a lower bar or different goalposts, I think that the breakdown of leadership at Florida State, a school that we debated as a potential blue blood. Now, of course, I will say again, I do not think Florida State is a blue blood, but they certainly have had the winning to be considered one of the top programs in the country. The breakdown between head football coach Jimbo Fisher, athletic director Stan Wilcox, the boosters, and the university administration, the breakdown in communication, and the fact that all of them were not on the same page resulted in not just one year, but multiple years of disappointing performances at a school where we know national championships can be won. So I do think that you have to, the role of the athletic director is important, but it is almost more important to me in terms of being able to maintain all the communication, be a little political, be able to understand what everybody wants, and be able to be a middleman or middle woman for communication with all those different parties.
Yeah, and I think that while they're different jobs, I feel like there is a lot of similarity to being the athletic director and being the actual coach, because like you mentioned, with all the people you have to deal with when you're running an athletic department, you have to have a personality that's forceful enough or strong enough to make clear what your vision is and what you want to have happen, but you also have to be flexible enough to deal with a lot of people who are going to have the same kind of personalities and figure out a way to make it all mesh where not there aren't giant egos and people are butting heads and everything falls apart, kind of like what you mentioned at Florida State. So it's not an easy job. So I feel like just to dismiss it as saying, it's easy if you're, you know, running at Alabama. In some ways, like you were going over, it could be more difficult to be the AD to blue blood because there are so many factions that want control or want to feel as if they're a part of it.
Yeah, let Alabama go 9-3 next season and see how easy it is to be the athletic director when the people that are like running the finances for the entire state are filling up your voicemail.
Mm-hmm.
All right, next question. This one comes a little bit specific. I don't want to go all specific all off season, but I'm going to try to. If you've got something that is just zeroed in on one team, you know, we'll pick this out and bring them to the forefront throughout the off season. So listen, we got some passionate Cincinnati football fans. We'll get to you. I promise. Just keep tuning in. Dylan says, How much does adding a former superstar like DeMarco Murray help Oklahoma in recruiting? Also, Jamar Cain seemed to have great success recruiting out west with Arizona State. Does that have an impact on Oklahoma, and does it make it even more difficult for schools like USC who are struggling in the state of California? Dylan sounds like a big Sooners fan. Barton, I'll let you get first crack at this. Your thoughts on some of the OU coaching staff additions for Lincoln Riley?
I think DeMarco Murray is the jury's still out. You know, we don't really know. He's only been, I think, 1 year at Arizona before jumping over to Oklahoma. Obviously he's still a legitimate name. I think he's a name that resonates. He's young. He's fresh out of the NFL not too long ago. So obviously guys want to be able to learn from players that have that kind of experience. But I actually think that the kind of the more significant hire is the Jamar Cain hire. When we looked up at Arizona State and the way it was attacking the state of California, it was sort of a two-pronged front. It was Antonio Pierce attacking Southern California, and it was Jamar Cain and what he was doing in Northern California. And I think Oklahoma is a program that has to have, and they've had some spots of success in Northern California as well in recruiting, and I think this will continue to help them zero in on that. And they've got to recruit nationally. They've got to jump into that open fence out west that everyone else is capitalizing on. And I think they, in particular on the defense, I mean, this program's going to be able to recruit well offensively regardless. But I think Jamar Cain is a coach that can help Oklahoma really, really ramp it up in out west, and in particular in Northern California.
Tom, you got any Oklahoma recruiting feels?
I mean, I think that DeMarco Murray has a boost. Just I don't know how much like of a huge boost DeMarco Murray is. Maybe he helps you in the Dallas area as a former Cowboy, but DeMarco Murray doesn't strike me as the kind of guy. I know he had a successful career at Oklahoma, but the people who are going to care about DeMarco Murray at Oklahoma being a great Oklahoma running back are the kids who already cared about Oklahoma to begin with.
I think that if you're going to do this, like, I will consider it a successful stint when you've been a coach or you've been associated with the program in that coaching recruiting role for long enough that I need to see that Ed Reed gets hired by the Miami staff, that DeMarco Murray gets hired by the Oklahoma staff, and be like, oh wow, and then I need to forget about it, and then I need to creep up and look up in a couple years. And see that, to your example, Barton, that Antonio Pierce is killing it in recruiting. And that's,
well, that's exactly
like,
what I'm getting.
Oh,
like that,
okay.
Yeah. That's the key, because I could rattle off a bunch of names of recognizable former players that probably on the surface people get excited about as a hire and who are dead weight on their coaching staff. From a recruiting standpoint, at the very least, and oftentimes more than that. So it's all about, you know, Antonio Pierce is a great example of a former NFL guy who jumped in and is totally committed to trying to be really good at this. And this is not a commentary of me thinking DeMarco Murray is not this. I just don't know. And so it's all about DeMarco Murray. Like, how if he really wants to be really good at this, then I bet you he's going to be a big time force, but I don't know the answer to that yet.
Yeah, if DeMarco Murray is a ardent recruiter and works really hard at it, being DeMarco Murray will help.
Right.
If he's just thinking that I'm DeMarco Murray is going to be it, then no, that's not going to do anything.
I'm DeMarco Murray.
And that's, oh my God, I want to play for Oklahoma.
Yeah, exactly. All right, this next...
Who is that person that they're recruiting, though? Like, I think maybe they need to get a different targets list.
He's
that
creepy
voice.
Bested. He's a freshman. He hasn't really...
That's a recruiting coordinator problem, not a DeMarco Murray problem. Get that guy off the list.
All right, this next question comes from P-Rock. P-Rock asks, love this pod. The three hosts have unbelievable chemistry. Kind of stinks this is a dog podcast now. I could do without
them. Hey, watch out.
This is...
Did you get your package, Barton?
I did get my package. What are we gonna do with those shirts?
Well, I'm wearing mine right now. Chip doesn't have his yet.
I took a picture of mine in a mirror, and I was gonna do something with it, tweet it out, but then I got sidetracked, and you know. But yes, I have my Fanatics, my Phantom Fanatics package of the year has come in.
All right, when we get our, I guess we can all wear them for the Golden Dumbbell Awards. It can be our tuxedos. Let's see. That being said, Team No Recline is the galaxy brain move here. As Chip and Tom said, we are mentally tough enough to not recline. We're the type of people who strive to make everyone's day a little better, not some coastal elite Ivy League grad who feels the need to make everything about himself. Cough, Barton, cough.
And that's the whole question. That's a very good question. Thank you, P-Rock.
Okay, P-Rock. P-Rock, you went downhill quick, man. I was such a P-Rock fan, and then you come at me. Here's the deal, P-Rock. You got it all wrong. This is not a selfish thing. The team recline. I am taking one for the team and allowing you to recline. Because I'm not saying I'm going to need to recline. I'm saying that you in front of me might need to recline, and my 6'3" knees will take the hit. Put it on my shoulders. You know what? I'll take it for you.
Now who's galaxy braining?
Mailbag question from P-Rock says, at what point, if ever, do you think college players who are fringe NFL prospects will turn to the XFL to get playing time and develop further? We haven't talked much XFL on here. PJ Walker's been killing it, though. Takes me back to the AAC days of
the St. Louis game looked freaking like rocking.
Yeah, they were hyped.
It was packed.
That was awesome.
They were loud. I haven't watched a ton. I mean, I have watched some the last 3 weeks, so it's like each week I've watched some XFL, and I mean it's much better than the AAF was, in my estimation, but it's still not good enough for me to where it's like it's pulling me in and I want to watch it. Although there are some interesting rule changes that I do like and keep my interest a little bit. But as for the question, I don't think it'll be that long, honestly. I think that if the XFL survives this year, and it's starting to look like it will, then I would think that this spring there are going to be some players who aren't drafted who will get some training camp invites, who will then not make it, who will then get XFL interest. I think the more interesting question to me is, at what point does the XFL lure somebody who has NFL draft potential by offering them a lot of money and saying, hey, you can come as a sophomore or as a freshman? I think that's the more interesting question. That, for me, that's what I'm going to be interested in following. But I think that right away, the XFL will be seen as some prospects who don't have NFL jobs will be something that they want to turn to. Like you said, it's work. It wouldn't be surprised if PJ Walker is in an NFL training camp this summer.
He's been one of the best players in the league so far.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't think it'll ever threaten the NFL. Not that that's what you're saying, Tom. And I don't think it'll ever threaten college football. But I do think that you're going to see spot cases of guys that are willing to make a jump early. There's a guy, I'm blanking on who it is. He had an interception this past weekend. I want to say he was at like Virginia Tech or something, and something off field happened, and he would have had to just declare for the supplementary draft. And I guess he just decided to go XFL instead of coming back and sitting out a year. And he's probably going to play in the NFL next year. And with this being sort of just a whatever, making $70,000 or whatever they make as his holdover season. So I think that kind of thing is probably going to take place here and there. But again, I doubt it's going to be a movement to the extent where it threatens sort of the product of college football.
I could see it threatening the junior college football scene, where it starts to take the spot of the landing spot year, where that you do have something happen off the field, or you've got something that happens either academically, you end up getting kicked out of a program, but you want to be able to still keep yourself in the mix to play professional football, if those rules are amended such that players would be able to use the XFL for that purpose, I could see that. Like, it's almost the, you know, in basketball, the players who are opting not to go to college but maybe play overseas for a little bit, the XFL almost becomes the overseas option.
Yeah, I mean, there's, if the XFL sticks around long enough, there are plenty. I mean, you look at how many teams there are, how many players are on scholarship across the country. Some of them aren't interested in being in school. And some of them at some point, if the XFL looks like it's a legit thing, are going to say, I'm just going to go do that until I can see if I get an NFL gig.
And I actually think too, you know, like as long as college football continues the rule of you can't leave until you're 3 years out of high school, I think that's the college football product's always going to be strong. Cause I ultimately that's why I can't follow college basketball anymore. Cause you don't, like, in the office, ESPN Classic will be playing old college basketball games, and you're watching these names that you recognize and are familiar with because they're juniors and seniors and they've been playing for 4 years, and that never happens in college basketball anymore, it feels like. And so, I think as long as there's sort of stability with name recognition in college football, even if you're losing a couple of quality players here and there to an XFL type of league, I think the college football product will still be strong.
All right. Let's see. And let's do one more here. This was another follow-up. Hey, The Real Coconut asks, hey, y'all, love the podcast. I just wanted to bring to light an omission from your pod on February 17th regarding the states that would receive boosts and drops if you could only recruit in-state lines. Hawaii would get a huge boost. Tua, Manti Te'o, Mariota, and more. Roll Rainbow Warriors.
That's I think that's, yeah, I'm with it.
Because, I don't know.
No, here's the reality is, because like the Hawaii is never getting any of those in-state players that are elite. And there is Hawaii is like a unique state where there's not a lot of elite players, but the couple that are elite are as good as you're going to find anywhere. And so I actually will, I mean, they're not going to beat LSU with our you have to recruit in state rule, but there's, I think absolutely Hawaii would probably maybe be of the group of five schools, the biggest beneficiary of this ridiculous rule. It's never going to happen.
I mean, I think that it would definitely improve Hawaii football as far as its strength overall. But at the same time, like those three names that he mentioned, Tua, Marcus Mariota, Manti Te'o, they weren't in college at the same time. So if you just have one of those guys at a time, like you give Marcus Mariota or Tua Tagovailoa.
Marcus Mariota gives way to Tua Tagovailoa, gives way to Jaden Delaria, gives way to Dylan Gabriel, who gives way to Jalen Delaria. Like there's not going to be four really good quarterbacks in the state of Hawaii, but every year it seems like there's one pretty good one. Mm. Yeah, there's not going to be, and look, they're going to get. I'm just looking at, so look at the 2019 state of Hawaii.
Oh, okay.
All right, class. State rankings: Washington, Ohio State, USC, Washington, Notre Dame, UCLA, Washington, UCF, Navy, BYU, USC, Washington State, UCLA, Arizona State, Washington, UCF, Hawaii, San Diego State. That's the top 20.
That's pretty good.
Yeah, that's pretty good. I mean, if you're a group of five school that's all of a sudden going to get 25 Power Five players a year, pretty good.
Yeah. Okay. Fair enough.
That's five of them are four stars. You know, not taking down LSU, but 100% a boost from where they are now in terms of the risers and fallers in the calculations.
Apologies to the real coconut. You were right.
The real coconut. You're right. All right. I think it's good for mailbag. Y'all want to take it to the book club?
Let's do it. Cover three.
So the Cover 3 Book Club, since we're friends, you know, the three of us are friends, all of our listeners are our friends as well. This is the off season. This is reading season, because otherwise all we're doing is watching football in our spare time. So it's good to have recommendations from our friends.
All right. Here we go. You all both had good thinking, some good thinking books.
Entertain us, Chip.
I'm glad that you said entertainment, because I'm gonna take us a little bit more on the musical style here, and I decided that, you know, maybe This Is Your Brain on Music by Daniel J. Levitin, a book about the way that your brain works and the different parts of your brain and the way that they respond to music. That one was not going to be very entertaining. But what if I told you that there was a history book that combined dealing with segregation and integration, dealing with workers' rights, the sanitation department strikes, dealing with the owning and building up of small business and of black business in the 1960s and the 1970s, payola scandals and the wild, wild west of the record business, and the Lorraine Motel as well, for reasons both good and bad. The book is called Respect Yourself, Stax Records and the Soul Explosion by Robert Gordon. It is a history book about Stax Records, where you will find Booker T and the MGs, Rufus and Carla Thomas, Sam and Dave, Otis Redding, Isaac Hayes. The list does have a lot of musicians that you might know if you're a fan of soul music, but the book itself, I think, reads as a fun American pop culture book. I mentioned the Lorraine Motel. That is where Dr. King was assassinated, but it was also the hangout spot for Stax. And so a lot of music and culture and history, all of it was sort of going on in Memphis at that time. The company itself was started by a brother-sister combination, a white brother-sister combination in a black neighborhood in very much segregated Memphis in the 1950s. And sort of the way that both racial and cultural lines were all blended together provide a lot of ups and downs, a lot of tension throughout the book. And so, you know, whether you're a diehard music fan or not, I don't think that you necessarily need to know the artists, because I consider myself someone who knew the artists. But in reading the book, I was enjoying it much more learning about the people that were running the record company that was, again, like small independently owned business in a very large, occasionally corrupt music industry, and the challenges that they had to overcome, the people who would go out on tour, the people that would book the tours. There was a lot more to it than just knowing the names of the artists and the names of the songs. And so if you want to dive a little bit into some Memphis history, if you want to dive into some civil rights history, all of it sort of comes together with the history of Stax Records in Memphis, and the book is called Respect Yourself.
So who are some of the musicians and or songs that are recognizable from this account?
Well, Sam. Like, well, I mean, like Soul Man. I'm a Soul Man. Da 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 da.
All right, all right, yeah.
Hold on, I'm coming. Hold on, bum, bum, bum. I'm coming.
So all the Wedding Circuit songs.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Shaft. Isaac Hayes did the whole soundtrack for Shaft.
Otis Redding.
Yeah. Sitting on the Dock of the Bay. So.
Yeah. No. That's how did you stumble across this book? Was this back in your, when you were sort of in your music, your aspirational music days?
It was not in my aspirational music days. It was a recommendation from somewhere. I don't know. I can't ask for it for Christmas one year. It was on my bookshelf for like another year. And then I picked it up and read it. And I was like, wow, this is a lot more than just an encyclopedia of liner notes. Like, you know, liner notes, when you open up a CD or an album, for all you kids out there might not understand that, you know, the liner notes just told you who played, guitar, bass, drums on all the different tracks, who wrote them. And that information is in this book. But that's not the way that I would sell this book to a friend. because that stuff is something that I enjoyed selfishly, was finding out that the guy who played trombone on, for example, Soul Man, also played piano on Sitting by the Dock of the Bay. Like, there are some of that really deep music history nerd facts in the book, but the reason that it was a page turner had more to do with meeting the characters around Memphis, around the music industry, and sort of all the different ups and downs that they had during a really challenging time for America, especially at the time.
It has been added to my shopping list. And if I had a dollar for every book that I have bought that has sat or gotten as a gift that has sat on the bookshelf for 2 years before I picked it up and read it and then thought to myself, oh, why didn't I read this sooner?
Memphis is a pretty dope place. Like, that's a cool city. I'd be interested in getting into some of that history.
They dive into some of the local Memphis politics at the time and sort of, you know, all the, you know, this one mayor who was, you know, really progressive and helping lead to a lot of the changes in an incredibly segregated city. You've got the, you know, some local Tennessee races that certainly dealt with the support of the musicians. And I don't know, it's got a lot to it. Packs a big punch.
So, like, in a two sentence way to summarize it, it is a tale of a time period, and it's kind of a history of America at that point in time told through a record company.
Right.
Yeah.
Cool.
It's good
I'm
stuff.
With it.
Nice.
It's on my list.
All right. I passed the test. I was a little bit intimidated, you know. A lot of guys coming with the deep think books. And I'm like, I don't know if they're gonna
worry.
Like it.
I will get into the dumb guy books very soon.
We have Range, we have A Life Well Played by Arnold Palmer, we have Fooled by Randomness, and we have Respect Yourself as our Cover 3 book list book so far.
Yeah, that's right. If you want to add a recommendation, because you are our friend, you can do so by leaving a 5-star review and throw your book club recommendation in there. We will mention it on the show, and we'll take a dive into it ourselves, because it's reading season. It's reading season, Barton.
Reading season. It's only one reading season, and we're in it.
We're in it. All right.
8 reading seasons, 12 months a year.
Of course. You can follow him on Twitter at Barton Simmons. You can follow him at Tom Fernelli. You can follow me at Chip_Patterson. Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Deserve.
It's the UEFA Champions League on Paramount Plus. Europe's top club soccer tournament. Champions versus champions. The best teams facing off in the knockout rounds.
Magnificent!
And it all takes place
while you're filling out financial reports at work. In the middle of your day, in the middle of your week. So use that second screen. Call in sick. Do whatever you gotta do to tune in Tuesdays and Wednesdays. Nobody watches the UEFA Champions League like us. Stream every match live exclusively on Paramount Plus.